You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, yesterday we had the pot bowl, and Louise and I went to dinner last night, and we had a date, and just the two of us. It's really nice. You do it, you know, we should do it more often. I think we probably only do it three or four times a year, but we took each other out, and it was just before the Super Bowl was starting, and of course the restaurant had the game on the TV. And the waiter comes over and says, you rooting for Denver or for Seattle? And I said, or for, you know, whatever he said. And I said, well, both states have decriminalized pot, so I'm actually rooting for both of them. And he thought that was rather, at first he looked shocked, and then he thought it was hysterical. And I think he went back and told a few other people because they were chuckling. But apparently it was a rather boring game. What was it, 48 to nothing, or 97 to 5, or the actual score was what? What was it? What was it, Jim? 43 to 7. Yeah, that's my recollection. Or to 8. Yeah. But in any case, you know, we embrace. You know, what happened to America being the base? You know, what happened to the baseball being the sport of America? I am still a baseball fan. I love watching baseball. Football, it's kind of interesting, but they were doing some, on the game last night, some real close-up shots of these guys running into each other, and you could see heads snapping and bodies popping and, you know, bones, you know, tendons being torn. I mean, you could just see it. It's like, is this really, I mean, you know, are we the last ages of the Roman Empire? I mean, these are our gladiators? Baseball is so much more civilized. Anyway, that's not the trash football. Increasingly what we're discovering is that it does serious damage. These people harm themselves for our entertainment. Now, they're paid well to do it. And this nonprofit corporation gets us to pay most of the bills. You know, we build stadiums and we build... You know, we pay their taxes because it's a not-for-profit corporation. They pay themselves very well, thank you very much. I have some problems with the NFL. But that's not what I wanted to talk about. There's a bunch of things I wanted to get into today. But one of the most important, I think, is we saw this weekend in the loss of Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died at the age of 46. The terrible tragedy of our war on drugs. Now, let me explain. I found this really interesting. Mike Gallagher is one of my colleagues. He's a conservative talk show host. I think he's over on Salem Radio. And I don't know him well. You know, we've met a few times, but speak at the same conferences and things. But over on his website, MikeOnline.com, he said, another senseless death, this time one of the greatest actors of our times. I wonder if he started with marijuana. If you want to get pot lovers mad, dare to even ask the question if an Oscar-winning movie star who's found dead in his bathroom with a needle stuck in his arm started with marijuana. He's opposed to decriminalizing pot. And I guess you would assume from Mike Gallagher's statement that we can expect to see an explosion of heroin overdoses now in Washington State and Colorado. And I think it's this uninformed, jingoistic perspective, which is widely embraced in America. Talkers Magazine, the this is how I learned of what happened, you know, Mike's experience. What Mike Gallagher said, because Talker says that he got over 50,000 views and death threats against him, his family, and his dog for posting this on his website. But I mean, mostly, you know, hey, this guy's getting some publicity, right, for coming out and saying this. I think it's just a sad state of affairs. The the fact of the matter is, if you look at the experience of the United Kingdom and Switzerland and Canada up until last November, which had turned heroin into a prescription drug and treated heroin addiction as a public health problem rather than a crime, that heroin doesn't ravage the liver the way alcohol does, and heroin doesn't cause lung cancer the way smoking does. This is not a pro-heroin pitch. I actually think that there are medicinal values and even recreational values to pot. I don't think that of heroin. But that said, there actually is a medicinal value for heroin. It's a very, very powerful painkiller. I mean, you know, if morphine doesn't quite work but is almost getting you there, prescription heroin should be available, in my opinion. I mean, it was originally sold as a cough medicine for children by Bayer. They came up with a brand name, heroin. You can find online pictures of the old 1918 bottles of heroin cough syrups for children. It works. And it does work. It just has this side effect of being very addictive. But the principal two side effects of the use of heroin are addiction and the things that come along with it being illegal, which are principally disease and the threat of imprisonment. And if what Switzerland and England found was that when they made heroin a prescription drug and said to doctors, and very carefully supervised, doctors who are specialists in addiction, not just, you know, any old doc, you may prescribe this to addicts to treat their addiction. And the heroin addicts would come into these clinics three times a day and shoot up, literally shoot up, with a brand new fresh needle. That their rates of HIV and hepatitis and other blood-borne infections plummeted, crime dropped, because these guys didn't have to steal anymore to support a habit. Many of these heroin addicts continued their heroin addiction, but went back into the workplace, gained weight, got healthy, got jobs, and eventually quit using heroin. There have been a dozen documentaries done on this. There's all you have to do is go to YouTube and type in prescription heroin. And you'll see the BBC has done documentaries on it. The CBC has done documentaries on it. There's a brilliant one done by Dutch television. In public health circles, this is not contested. So, A, the idea that because Colorado and Washington State have legalized pot, you're going to see an increase in the use of heroin. That's nonsense. You're going to see a decrease in the use of heroin in those states because people no longer have to need to go to illegal marketplaces to buy pot. And those illegal marketplaces where people were buying pot are also the places where heroin is sold. Number one. So actually, my prediction is 5 years from now, we're going to look back and we're going to be able to see the clear epidemiological trend that the use of heroin, and not just heroin, heroin, cocaine, and all the other illegal drugs that can be very, very destructive, that they are going, that their use is going to decline in those states. My prediction, number one. And number two, I think it's time for us to declare an end to the war on drugs. If Philip Seymour Hoffman had been able to go to a clinic or a doctor and say, I have an addiction disease, and get prescription heroin, or if he had had access, I guess he had a lot of money, he had access to the opportunity to get clean, he might not be dead right now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, I realize that sounds counterintuitive. What? Give heroin to heroin addicts? But it actually has worked in these countries. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nate Sweet is calling in. We'll put him on the air in just a second. So, he's not? He is? Yeah, put him on the line. I can't put him on the air. Hang on just a minute. And we'll find out what's going to be on the big picture tonight. I know I just shared with you my rift on heroin. And we will be talking about that. I still don't have Nate on the board. Okay, there we go. Nate is now on the board. Hey, Nate.
What are they going to do about the
Oh, you're not Nate. Hang on just a minute. He's on line three. Nate, and can we put Nate on the board, please, so I can put him on the air? I'm sorry. In our daily take tonight. Oh, there we go. Line 11. Okay. Nate Sweet? Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. Good to have you with us. My apologies.
Good to get on.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it takes a while. By the way, something in the daily take that we need to add is that there are really three negative side effects to heroin right now. The third one is the threat of imprisonment.
Mm, okay.
And, you know,
that makes sense.
It could just be a sentence, but it needs to be mentioned because there are a lot of people in prison because of heroin. And they shouldn't be. They should be in a hospital.
Right, exactly. It's a public health problem.
Yep. So anyhow, tell me about tonight's show.
So we're starting off. We'll have Casey Lefkowitz. She's the director of the International Program for the National Resource Defense Council. The big news this on Friday and passing over into this week was the State Department's environmental review of the Keystone XL pipeline. They said accepting the pipeline won't have any drastic impact on climate change in the environment. A lot of people are calling that report out for some suspect reasons. I mean, the contractor that was employed to write the report had previously done work for the company that's building the pipeline. So there's some questions there, but there are also some questions really about their methodology and right. whether or not they accurately reflected the whole picture.
Yeah. In other words, the administration has always wanted to go along with this. If they hadn't wanted to, they could have stopped construction. They could have stopped the eminent domain processes all along the way, and they didn't.
What I really don't get is it's either the president believes in this project or he's doing it out of a belief in its political expedience, but I don't really see what political expedience he gets out of it. He's a second-term president, and he's not really going to harm
He is the head of the Democratic Party.
Right.
And the Democratic Party needs money. And thanks to the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision and the ones that preceded it, the fossil fuel industry, there's a reason why the president can go on national television and say we should stop giving the fossil fuel industry $4 billion in gifts every year, and it doesn't happen, and that's because they provide a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not just – and by the way, they provide money not just to politicians. They also – watch your TV tonight and notice
watch
the ads.
MSNBC.
Yeah, or any network. And what you're going to see is a lot of ads for fossil fuels, whether it's natural gas or whether it's oil or whether it's clean coal or whatever.
Speaking of companies that rip off the public interest, we'll be talking in Block B with Michael Woods, writer for ESPN, about how the NFL is essentially a subsidized non-for-profit. Under legal category, it's a non-profit, but really everybody knows it's a profit-making entity, and that allows it to have access.
But as a non-profit, they don't have to pay property taxes. We do. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, and then Conversations with Great Minds, Keith Ellison is going to be with us.
Yeah.
Okay, Nate Sweet. Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to see you. We'll be back. Welcome back. John Hartman here with you, and the middle class is steadily eroding. Just ask the business. I said there's a bunch of things I wanted to share with you. Actually, I'll start out with a funny one. It's not so funny, actually, when you think about how aggressively the Republican Party and so-called conservatives have, since the Reagan administration, during this 33-year era of Reaganomics that we've been living through, have been refusing to fund infrastructure. You know, we very rarely build new schools in America or new hospitals or new roads, and we built virtually no new rail, no new high-speed rail, nothing of consequence. About the most we've done is expand a few airports. So Rich in Minneapolis shares with me a story that Pete Seeger told him he was driving Pete Seeger to the airport after a gig in Madison, Wisconsin. And Pete Seeger told him this socialist joke, he called it. And he wrote a song based on the socialist joke, that's he being Rich. And so he sent it. Then he says, I felt funny using Pete Seeger's material in that way. And we contacted him, sent him the song, promised to give him credit for the joke, and asked for his permission to sing it. Pete wrote right back that it was fine if we used the joke because he had stolen it from Carl Sandburg. Okay, so here's the joke. A mother fly laid 2 eggs. A breeze came along and blew them out the door. One laid on a hot, dry stretch of pavement. The other landed on a delicious, decaying, dead cat. Time passed. The eggs hatched into maggots. The maggots on the decaying cat grew healthy, while the maggot in the gutter suffered terribly. One day they met, and the gutter maggot asked the decaying cat maggot how he managed to look so good. Came the reply, hard work and perseverance, my friend, hard work and perseverance. You get it? It's like, you know, the dead cat is the infrastructure. Good schools, good roads, good, you know, a functioning court system, a non-corrupt political system, a press that actually tells the truth, news that's actually news rather than infotainment, an infrastructure, a political, economic, social infrastructure, medical infrastructure, healthcare for all, you know, pensions for everybody, a good functioning social security system. All of these things, they're the dead cat, right? They're the infrastructure in which that maggot grew healthy and strong. They're the soil in which businesses and the middle class in America can grow healthy and strong. And for 33 years, we've been operating in this world of free trade, low tax, less regulation Reaganomics. And that infrastructure is crumbling. I mean, just the coarse physical infrastructure, just to take us back where we were when Reagan came into office, would cost us $2 trillion, according to the American Society of something or other engineers, bridge engineers or something. And then, I mean, you look at what countries like, you know, Korea, South Korea or Japan or many of the countries of Europe are doing, where we could be going so much farther with infrastructure. We could be laying high-speed fiber optic cable, and we could be providing a news and intellectual infrastructure to people across our country. I mean, there's a couple of cities that are doing this, where the city runs the broadband system. So the ISP is always going to be net neutral. But I think that there's 2 cities in the United States that are successfully doing this. It's the exception rather than the rule. We need to be adding infrastructure. We need to be building infrastructure. So anyhow, it's a great joke. But instead, what we're doing is, at 33 years of Reaganomics, has brought us this. Nelson Schwartz writing today in the business section of the New York Times. And he starts out talking about how in New York, Lehman's, L-O-E-H-M-A-N-N, I'm not a New Yorker, I don't know how it's pronounced, but it's a chain of basically discount clothing stores that, quote, the middle class, end quote, used to shop at. The kind of stores that I went to as a kid. My dad worked as a tool and die worker. We had a nice life, but it was decidedly American working class, lower middle class. And so I remember when I first year of high school, there was some sort of big event, prom or something. I forget what it was. And I got my first suit. And Dad took me to Robert Hall, which back then was like sort of like Joseph A. Bank now. I mean, it wasn't a Saks Fifth Avenue or, you know, a special designer, but it wasn't Walmart. It was one of these kind of midline stores. And I was so proud of that suit, and Dad was so proud that he could buy it for me. Well, that was the middle class. Those stores are going away. And what is rising? Well, as Nelson Schwartz says in the New York Times, he says, Wall Street analysts, he says, within top consulting firms and among Wall Street analysts, the shift is being described with a frankness often associated with left-wing academics, or more often associated with left-wing academics than business experts. John G. Maxwell, head of the global retail and consumer practices at PricewaterhouseCoopers, said, quote, those consumers who have capital like real estates and stocks and are in the top 20% are feeling pretty good. So what's happening is all over the country, high-end retailing is booming. The top 20%, which would be people, you know, I don't know where the top 20% begins. I know the top 1% begins at around $300,000 a year. I'll have to pull out the quintiles and get it, but I would guess that that's probably a top 20% is probably in the neighborhood of something over $90,000 or $100,000 a year. That group of people is now accounting for the big boom in retailing right now in the United States. Everybody else is in trouble.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's not just 30 years of stagnant wages. It's also an explosion in things like student debt and the cost of housing. Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. Okay, the Tax Policy Center from the Brookings Institution has the quintiles. So basically, the top fifth of Americans, the quintile, quint is Latin for five, I think, or quince, whatever. And so a quintile is a fifth. And so we divide America in terms of income into fifths. Keep in mind, this is income, as in, you know, money you take every year as opposed to wealth, which is the money you have and the assets you have. So you are in the bottom fifth of American income if you make less than $20,262. The mean, by the way, for the bottom fifth is $11,000 a year. So, you know, you're right in the middle of the bottom fifth at $11,000 a year, but you're at the top of the bottom fifth at $20,000. You're at the top of the second fifth at $38,000. You're at the top of the third fifth at $62,000. You're at the top of the fourth fifth at $101,000. You're at the top of the, you're in, actually, they don't have numbers for the top of the highest fifth. And I'm not. Shane says, because the sky's the limit. Yeah, of course. Warren Buffett, I mean, you know, whatever. He's in the top fifth. So there is no upper limit, I guess. You had a couple of people making $2 billion last year on Wall Street. There were 10 people. But the mean, half is above, half is below, of the highest fifth is $178,000 a year. So basically what they're saying is that the people, so, and the upper limit of the fourth quintile is $100,029. So that would be the kind of the bottom of the top fifth would be $100. So basically, if you make more than $100,000 a year, you're in the top fifth of income earners in the United States as a household. And, you know, there's a surprising number of people in that top fifth quintile, you know, two income households where they're both working a good union job, you know, a teacher, a firefighter, one's making $51,000, the other's making $55,000, you know, they're bringing home $106,000. That's, and in, you know, the more expensive places to live around this country, that's still tight. And that's the top fifth. But the middle of the top fifth at $178,000, the top, If you make over $186,000 a year, you're in the top 5%. With the mean at the and if you make over $180,000 a year, you're in the top. Yeah, no, that's it. If you make over $186,000, you're in the top 5% of American incomes. So, very interesting. In any case, the point is that the American middle class, what we used to call the middle class, or maybe more correctly, what Europeans would call the working class, is really, really struggling. My dad's kind of job, you know, the manufacturing jobs, they're not paying the kind of pay they used to back then, which in today's dollars would be $20, $30, $40 an hour, depending on how many years and what kind of, whether you were a journeyman or just a laborer. And instead, you know, they're paying $7, $9, $12, $15 an hour, maybe if it's a really good job. And that's a tough one. So we're seeing the American middle class just being hollowed out. by 33 years now of Reaganomics. By the way, Don Siegelman is still in prison. Free-don.org for more information about that. And tonight on our TV show, we're going to have Keith Ellison on for a half hour with our Conversations with Great Minds. Just a heads up on that. So a lot going on. Oh, and the other big news is on Friday, the State Department came out and said, with regard to the Keystone XL pipeline, just keep on moving along. No droids in this car. We are going to be talking about that at some length in the third hour of the program when Ryan Kornowski is going to be on. He's the deputy editor of Climate Progress, and he's got a piece out, Seven Things the State Department Didn't Want to Tell You About. And Dave, in central Nebraska, you wanted to talk about the Keystone XL vigils going on tonight. You're organizing one?
Hi, Tom. You've got Nina. Dave had to take care of the chickens so we can go to the vigil.
Oh, okay.
Yes. We're central Nebraska against the KXL pipeline tonight at 5 o'clock at Webb Road and State Street in Grand Island.
Mm-hmm.
We have signs. We have banners. They may make their own. Right now I have about 13 to 15 people coming, and we'd sure like to have more. We've also got the press coming.
That's great. And if you don't happen to be in Grand Island, Nebraska, you can organize your own vigil anywhere in the United States.
Even on your own porch.
Even on your own porch. What would you suggest the signs say? What do your signs say?
One of them that we made was no water, no life.
Right. And how does the Keystone XL pipeline, you know, what's the connection to the Keystone XL pipeline there? Pollution?
Well, the pollution and the toxic chemicals that are going to be going through the pipeline. We live in northeastern Howard County, which means that Greeley County is to the north, then Nance County and Merritt County, and that is the route of the pipeline. So whatever they put into the water, the Ogallala Aquifer, is going to contaminate the water that we drink.
Well,
that's our big concern.
Yeah, okay, great. No water, no life. Other signs?
We have, we're with boldnebraska.org. I don't know, perhaps you've seen Jane Kleb on Fox, has had her on. I don't know why no one else has.
I haven't seen her, no.
Yeah, well, she's been on. Boldnebraska.org is a place that you can go to get more information.
How do you spell bold?
B-O-L-D.
Oh, bold. Oh, bold Nebraska, as in bold progressives. Yeah, okay, got it. Boldnebraska.org, okay.
We built a small barn over near York, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a little windmill and a solar panel.
Mm-hmm.
And is directly on the route. So if the pipeline is approved, that barn will have to be torn down.
They're going to have to tear down a solar wind-powered barn.
Yes.
Brilliant. Brilliant. You're doing good theater. I mean, and making a good statement. I mean that in the most positive way possible. Well, thank you very much. What was your name again? Your first name?
I'm Mina, M-E-N-A.
Mina. Oh, okay. Thank you, Mina. I thought you said you've got me. No, I didn't get it. It was Mina. Mina, thank you very much, and say hi to Dave for us, and good luck with your vigil tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And I hope the chickens are fine, right?
They're just getting a little hungry.
Just hungry. Oh, okay, good. All right. Thanks, Mina, and good luck. And let us know tomorrow how it worked out. I appreciate your call. Richard in Palmer, Idaho. Hey, Richard, you have a question about our money?
Tom. Hello, Tom. I enjoy your show.
Thank you. What's your question?
My question is, if there is supposed to be a separation of church and state, why does it say "In God We Trust" on a $1 bill?
Because of the godless communists and the John Birch Society. In the 1950s, and I'm pretty sure it was the 50s, I might be wrong, it might be another time, but my recollection of the story on this, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure somebody will call and correct me, but my recollection of the story on this is that sometime back in the 50s when Joe McCarthy was going nuts and all this stuff was going on, the communists, of course, were officially the Soviet Union, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and the communist Chinese were officially atheist. And so one of the ways that right-wing demagogues would want to distinguish themselves from the communists was to embrace religion and God. And so they proposed legislation suggesting that it should say "In God We Trust" on our money. And who would want to vote against that, especially in the time of the anti-communist, anti-atheist hysteria. And fortunately, the anti-atheist hysteria, I would say, is still with us. The anti-communism has kind of faded out. But my recollection is that that's when it happened and why. Does it make sense, Richard?
Yes.
Yeah.
Too bad we can't change it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, given the First Amendment and given the Establishment Clause that says that, and not just that, no religious test, there shall be no religious test for a person for, you know, political office or for appointment. I mean, all these things. I mean, the founders are very, very clear. You know, we're not about religion in this country. Richard, thank you for the call. Rosemary in Riverside, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Rosemary, we have a minute to the break. You wanted to comment on Pete Seeger?
Yes. Yeah, yes, Tom. I had a different take to that joke that you said about how the maggot, when his reply was that it was all to hard work and perseverance.
Right.
I kind of, when I heard that, I was like, I took it more as these hypocritical Republicans, basically, who'll say they've worked so hard for what they've gotten. And, you know, it was just by a fluke that fly egg landed on the cat.
Yeah, and on the dead cat, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it didn't. To me, it didn't seem. I found that interesting because I was like, I didn't take it as hard work and perseverance.
It was
so well in the infrastructure.
Yeah, no, it was obviously not hard work and perseverance. It was the fact that he landed on the egg landed on a dead cat, and that's the thing. By infrastructure, I meant, you know, things like a national health care system, you know, a good minimum wage. All of these things I think of as the infrastructure, the things that would, in many ways, make a person a modern socialist. And so I think that we're agreeing. I should have pointed that out, though. You're right that when the maggot from the dead cat said hard work and perseverance, obviously, you know, he was just mimicking this Republican meme that is long. Rosemary, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We really do. We really are all in this together. We do really need to have a society. As much as Ayn Rand would say, there's no such thing. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah. Shane says, I think the joke was more like the Lucky Sperm Club, you know, somebody who happens to be born into a wealthy family or happens to be born white or born with some advantage or whatever it may be. Virginia in Seattle watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Virginia, what's up? What's up?
Hi. Well, I agree that if you want to find out who's responsible, you got to follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still paying out on the bank's failure, and people are still losing their homes. But the interesting thing is that it's all illegal money. It's immoral to do what they're doing. It's what happened was when Kennedy was killed, he had Executive Order 11,110 laying on his desk, signed and witnessed and ready to go. But it's been laying around for 50 years. Nobody's paid any attention. He restored the production of money back to the U.S. Treasury, which is where it belonged in the first place. And so
I think that Kennedy did that for several years before he was killed, because you can find $5 bills that are issued by the Treasury. Somebody sent me one. We had this conversation on the air back when I was living in Portland, and somebody mailed me a $5 bill that had they're called the Red Seal bills, and it had a red seal on it, and on the top, instead of saying Federal Reserve Note, it said U.S. Treasury. And
well, those are going out too.
They only made them for a few years in the 60s.
Yeah, they're now a collector's item.
Yes, exactly. So it's not that Kennedy was killed to avoid this from happening, or that he was killed and this didn't happen. It had been happening for some time before he was killed, is my understanding. Or else it had happened for some time after. There was no relationship between that and his assassination.
It should be our Treasury printing our money.
I agree.
Not this Fed.
I agree. And I absolutely agree.
That was what it was all about, his yep. getting killed, from what I understand.
Well, I don't think so, but, you know, it is something that needs to be addressed. We should nationalize the Fed. I'm with you on that. We should be printing our own money. Lincoln did it. Kennedy did it. And, you know.
Why they were assassinated.
Yeah, both of them were. Yeah. But, I correlation is not necessarily causation. I think the fact that prior to the Kennedy administration, there had never been more than 11 or 12 prosecutions of organized crime in any one year in the history of America, because basically Trafficante and Marcello were blackmailing J. Edgar Hoover, and they had Nixon in their pocket, and he was the vice president in the Eisenhower administration. So, and then Kennedy comes in, and Bobby Kennedy just hated the gangsters because his father had always been associated with them. He just hated them, and he went after them. And there was something like 700 prosecutions of organized crime in the first year of the Kennedy administration. And that put the mob on notice. We're coming to get you guys. And they deported Marcello and dumped him in the middle of the desert down in, or the jungle rather, down in Guatemala. And he had to walk 3 days to get to a town and fly out, fly back and smuggle himself back into the United States. And I think that that was what drove the Kennedy assassination, not that they wanted to print money. The banksters have other ways of destroying people. But your point that we need to be printing our own money, Virginia, I completely agree with you. Thank you for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Up 79%, the headline over at the Huffington Post. Could that be because the country in the world that produces the most heroin is, get ready for it, drum roll, ta-da, Afghanistan. And we just happen to be shuttling tens of thousands of people and hundreds of thousands, if not more, pounds of equipment back and forth between the United States and Afghanistan every week, probably. I mean, after World War II, there were, you know, one of the, excuse me, I was sneezing here. One of the plot devices in a lot of novels that were written after World War II, and after the, in particular, was about guys who were in World War II, and they were over in Europe, and they found the stores of Nazi gold as GIs. And, five or six or 10 or 20 GIs and their commanding officer together would, like, you know, capture some little town someplace, and they'd find a room filled with gold that the Nazis had stolen, kill a bunch of Jewish families and steal their money, or just conquer an area and steal all the gold. And these GIs would melt the gold down and turn it into, like, you know, a steering wheel for an airplane and cover it with black paint, or, you know, a wing strut for an airplane or something. It's actually something that wasn't structural because gold is soft. And then when they get back to the United States, they take it off the plane and they could do that with heroin. And we are in Afghanistan. We had this, by the way, the last time we had this problem, we were in Vietnam. And the Chinese, they grow a lot of opium in China too, by the way. And the Chinese were making heroin, and they were supplying it to the Vietnamese, who were giving it to our soldiers. And we had a horrible heroin addiction epidemic during and immediately after the Vietnam War. One of my very best friends, a guy named Bill Call, who was probably the best guitarist, folk guitarist I have ever known in my life, died of a heroin overdose, as I recall. I've had several friends who were, you know, really, really struggled with heroin addiction. And I'm of the opinion that, you know, it's like the war comes home. You go off to Vietnam where there's a lot of heroin, you're gonna get a lot of heroin coming back home. You go off to Afghanistan where there's, you know, a lot of heroin. Now, George Bush, before 9/11, actually had a reasonable way to deal with this. In March of 2001, 6 months before 9/11, George Bush paid the Taliban in Afghanistan some $30 or $40 million. I mean, tens of billions of dollars. Now, it's nothing compared to the hundreds of billions and trillions that we're spending on the war. But he paid them a few tens of millions of dollars to destroy the poppy crops, because you know they didn't make that much money from the poppies. The selling of opium is not as profitable. You know, the farmers, it's where it all starts, and it's also one of the less profitable parts of the supply chain. Farmers grow the poppies, they milk the opium, they turn it into raw opium, they hand it off to refiners, and they sell it fairly cheap. Then the refiners turn it into heroin, and now it's got some serious value. They sell it to the smugglers, you know, for a lot higher price, but it's still relatively cheap. Once you get it out of the country, then it starts getting really, really expensive. So if you can stop it from ever being made in the first place, you get a worldwide supply shortage. Now, you know, arguably that drives prices up, but you drive prices up, and what happens? Usage goes down. Even with something highly addictive, we know this from cigarettes, which are 5 times more addictive than heroin. So we're having an epidemic of heroin use in the United States right now, and it took us at least a decade after the Vietnam War was over before anybody came out with any good investigative reporting, at least as I recall. And maybe it was being done. In fact, it was probably almost certainly being done at the time, and I just wasn't aware of it. But that, you know, an actual strategic part of how the communists were helping harm us for being in Vietnam was to supply our troops with heroin and get them addicted and help them smuggle it home. That I predict that if the investigative reporting has not already been done, it will be done. That it is that we're bringing back heroin right now. This stuff doesn't just appear out of nowhere. The war always comes home. So, anyhow, Karen in Portland, Oregon, you wanted to talk about heroin.
Yes.
Hi, Karen.
I think that we should have more methadone clinics
mm-hmm.
because I was a heroin addict for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and I moved to Portland where they have methadone clinics,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to get clean. I went to college, and I got a really good job. And then I found out I had hepatitis C from using dirty needles before
right.
I got on methadone.
Were you using the methadone while you were going to school and going and got your job?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's my point. And methadone is just as addictive as heroin. In fact,
definitely.
There are some studies that methadone is more addictive than heroin, and that's why I think that you know the Swiss and the British just said, you know, why bother with methadone? Methadone, by the way, was invented in the Germans. The most famous and probably one of the earliest methadone addicts in the world was Adolf Hitler.
The thing with methadone is that you only need to take it once a day.
That's right. Cause
you
it's,
can go it, in the morning and take it. And plus, when they do your dosage, you can go down and down. It's hard with heroin to measure how much you're taking.
Yeah.
So,
well, if it's pharmaceutical, it's not hard.
Right.
And that's what true. They do in Switzerland and in the UK. They say, okay, here's 2 milligrams of heroin, you know, or here's 4 milligrams or whatever it is. And you know exactly what you're getting, and they know exactly what you're getting, and you can downregulate the dose. So
people get icky when it comes to needles.
Yeah, you're right. And that's why I think methadone is more widely accepted, because people can drink it as a liquid or they can take it as a pill. Although you could arguably do that with heroin. I don't know anybody who's ever done that, so I can't speak from any kind of personal or even secondhand knowledge on that. Karen, thanks a lot for the call. I think you're making my point. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I was sharing with you earlier this piece from Nelson Schwartz in today's New York Times. The middle class is steadily eroding. Just ask the business world. Really? And we talked last week about Republican congressional candidate David Jolly, who is, as a Republican, asking to raise the minimum wage because he's sick and tired of you and me subsidizing Walmart to the tune of $1 million a store, subsidizing McDonald's, you know, in a similar fashion, because they pay such low wages that their workers qualify for food stamps and Medicaid and a whole host of government benefits. I suppose there's two ways to deal with that. One is to cut those government benefits, but then those people wouldn't be able to even work at Walmart or live, maybe. And the other is to raise the minimum wage. Peter Schiff is with us. He is the CEO and chief global strategist with Euro-Pacific Capital. He's the host of the Peter Schiff Show on the radio. And he's the author of his latest book, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F, radio.com is his website. Oops, and he just vanished. I put him on the air, and he just vanished. Oh, well. Maybe he will be coming back, maybe not. But in any case, the middle class is steadily eroding. And we need to figure out what we're going to do about this. You know, what are the possible solutions? Do we really want to be subsidizing Walmart? So, you know, it just seems like a reasonable step. Just, you know, here we go. Peter's back with us. Peter, sorry to drop you there.
Yeah, I'm on the phone.
Oh, your phone is breaking up. Say something again.
No, well, I'm on Skype and on the phone. Do you see me on Skype?
I do, but it's frozen. It froze.
It doesn't look frozen to me.
Oh, no, wait a minute. It's Jim's using a static picture.
Oh, but my image doesn't appear frozen.
We've got, for some reason, we're not getting your video, so.
All right, well, I see my video coming back to me, so usually that means it's being broadcast, because I can see it in a Skype window where the video would be.
Yeah, okay. Peter, we can't tech this right now, but we've got you on the phone. Let's talk.
All right, are you sure you don't want to, you know, give it a shot now that I'm down here in the studio dressed up with all the lights?
As we speak right now, Shane is trying to figure out what's going on and make it work.
You want to hang up and call me back?
No. Let's just continue.
No, not hang up on the phone. Hang up on Skype.
Shane says we're not connected on Skype.
No, I am. I see him.
You're not seeing Shane.
Well, I'm seeing somebody with glasses and a blue shirt.
Then you're connected to somebody other than us, because what we send you back is the Tom Hartman logo, and that's it. It's a static logo.
All right. Well, let me see.
Okay.
Maybe Tom Hartman. Oh no, that's okay. Chris Wallace.
There you go.
I've got.
So you're hooked up to Fox News. So
all right, so where is Tom? Did you?
Peter, let's just talk on the phone, okay? We've got 5 minutes to go here, and we're on the air, and you know we shouldn't be technical stuffing this. And my apologies that, you know, we didn't work all this out before we got on the air. We really should have. First of all, why not an increase in the minimum wage?
Well, I mean, it would destroy a lot of jobs. I mean, that's a big problem. We should, you know, get
Can you tell me when that's ever happened in the past?
Well, it's always happened. I mean, why do you think the minimum wage was first created? It was created by labor unions that wanted to price low-skilled workers out of the market by raising the cost of hiring them so that people would have to hire the more expensive, higher-skilled labor. It's always been designed
no.
to destroy employment. Yes, it is.
Go back and read your history. The minimum wage was created by FDR on the premise that if your business model is so bad that you can't pay somebody a decent living, you have no right to be in business. No. Teddy Roosevelt first proposed this. He was a Republican.
Minimum wage didn't start. It was actually Franklin Roosevelt that had the first minimum wage, not Teddy.
Teddy who proposed it.
Yeah, but they didn't think it up. I mean, they had it in Europe before we had it here.
No, they had a maximum wage in Europe.
No, but they had a minimum wage, too. And the minimum wage really didn't apply to the general public. It applied to federal workers in the 30s. But it wasn't until the 1960s that it was broadly applied. But if you look at unemployment rates, particularly among teenagers and young adults, before the minimum wage and now, it's night and day. I mean, you look at black teenagers. You have 40-50% unemployment now. Before the minimum wage, it was very low. In fact,
well, you're also looking at before Reaganomics and now.
Excuse me?
You're also looking at before Reaganomics and now. I mean, you know, 33 years of Reaganomics has ripped the guts out of the middle class in this country.
Well, that we haven't had Reaganomics for the past 30 years, but what
of course
the
we
problem
have.
Is, now, look,
top tax rate is now 74%.
Well, let me ask you a question about wages, because you know wages are prices, right? And you know when you buy things, do you look for the highest price or the lowest price?
Wages are only partially prices.
No, but it's the price of labor. If I hire somebody, the wages is my price. Plus, it's not just the wages. Of course, it's other payroll costs that the government lumps on top of it. But I have to hire people, and if you take the minimum wage and say, well, if you want to hire somebody, now it's more expensive to hire somebody, particularly people that don't have a lot of skills where you actually have to train them in addition to pay them, employers end up hiring fewer people because you raise the cost of hiring, you price people out of the market.
Okay, so I'm running a burger stand here, Peter, and I got one guy doing the fries, I got one guy flipping burgers, I got one person at the counter, and I got one person at the window. And, you know, that's fairly typical, and maybe one guy who cleans up and takes out the trash. Mm-hmm. The minimum wage goes up. Who do I get rid of, and how does that help my business?
Well, it would help your business if the minimum wage didn't go up, but you have to make your own decision as to what works for you. Depending on how much the minimum wage goes up, maybe it'll go up so much that it makes sense to replace your workers with a machine.
Why was it in Portland that when the minimum wage went up that the economy boomed? Why is it that every single time since the 30s the minimum wage has gone up, three years have seen significant increases in GDP?
Well, first of all, there's just because one thing happens and something else happens doesn't mean there's a causal.
Well, you were just arguing correlation is causation.
No. If you look at the countries around the world that have the lowest minimum wage or no minimum wage at all, they have the lowest rates of unemployment. And they
you mean like what, Syria?
No, well, like Switzerland and Singapore and, you know, Hong Kong didn't have one until a couple years ago. But, and, you know, we didn't always have one. Before we
had. Have you ever been to Singapore?
Faster economic growth and less unemployment.
Have you ever been to Singapore?
Yes.
I have too. Do you really want, you know, miles of slums of working people?
Obviously, you weren't there. I mean, they have the highest per capita income in the world in Singapore.
Because they have some very, very wealthy people.
More than the average American. So I don't know what you're talking about.
And in Switzerland, and as in, actually, probably the example you should have used is Sweden, which doesn't have a minimum wage.
Yeah,
because
well,
the country is 85% unionized.
Yes, I know.
There's no need for a minimum wage.
Excuse me?
There's no need for a minimum wage. Pretty much everybody's a member of a union.
No, but a lot of people are apprentices, you know, and, you know, they don't necessarily earn, you know, the top.
Right, but we don't have that here in the United States because 33 years of Reaganomics has ripped apart our manufacturing base, too.
That's not what's ripped apart our manufacturing base.
Yes, it's these insane trade policies that Reagan was promoting.
No, it's not. It has nothing to do with it. It's the high taxes and high regulation that's destroyed our manufacturing.
What was the top income tax rate when Reagan came into office?
It was higher than it is now.
It was 74%.
Yeah, but
what is it now?
You have to realize that the tax code then, I would rather have personally, for my own purpose, I would pay less income taxes right now with a 74% tax rate and the code when Reagan came in than what I'm paying now. I'm actually paying a much higher percentage of my income based on today's code than I would have if Ronald Reagan was president.
Then I would guess you're making less than $600,000 a year.
I'm making a lot more, but the deductions aren't there. But why don't we go back to before the income tax? When the income tax was zero, we had much faster economic growth back then. We didn't have this big gap between the rich and the poor.
The gap between the rich and the poor at the turn of the 19th century was massive, Peter.
No, it's much higher now.
It provoked a near revolution. Okay, Peter Schiff. Hang on just a second, Peter.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read all about it at Schiff Radio, SCHIFFradio.com. And Peter, I promise next time we'll get you on, we'll do
that. I didn't realize we were discussing the audio video live on the show.
Yeah, my apologies too. We'll be back. And welcome back. And Peter, if you can hear me on hold, I see that Pete's having a conversation with Bob. Thank you so much for being with us. Peter's still on hold. Anyhow, it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let me pick up some calls here. George in Sedona, Arizona. Hey, George, what's on your mind?
Hey, g'day, mate. I have to make a comment first. I just listened to your discussion with that other guy.
Yeah, Peter.
And we don't need a drug of choice anymore. All we have to do is dial up a Republican.
anyway. I'm sorry. I shouldn't laugh. I'm supposed to defend my guests.
I wanted to talk about 2016, the crash.
Mm-hmm. You mean my book or the possibility?
I got the book.
Uh-huh.
I got the book. And I read right up to the last chapter, I think, chapter 12 or in mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And I was that angry that I took it down to my bank manager, a small town bank, and asked him to read it also, because we'd been talking before about, the way the economy was going and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it for a week, and I went in one day and he said, can I have it for another 2 weeks? And when I got it back, he had made notation, just pieces of paper in the important parts. And I sat down at his desk and I said, did you like it? And he said, yes, very much. And I said, do you believe in it? And he said, yes, very much.
Wow.
So,
well, if he's a small-town banker, then he knows this stuff. I mean, because the small-town bankers are the victims of Wall Street as much as you and me and everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. I realized that right from the start, because when I had asked him about my partner's bank account, could it be frozen if another crash happened?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, everything will be okay and all that. And then I read someplace else that the insurance for old banks wouldn't be enough to carry probably 5% of
the money.
It's
not, but that's the bad news. The good news is that the federal government has the ability to just pour money into that. That's, the insurance that was used to prop up our banks to the tune of some $30 trillion, according to Bernie Sanders' audit, when they audited the Fed, that insurance didn't even exist when the banks crashed in 2008. So there's no doubt in my mind that if the banks were to crash, if we were to have a bank crash like we had in 33 in February, March, April of 33, that the FDIC insurance, at least the first $250,000 in your checking account, that the government would make good on it, even though the FDIC fund is not large enough to do it. There's no doubt in my mind.
Can I make just two comments on the drug problem you were talking about?
Yeah, we have just a minute. So be quick about it.
I worked around an antique village, not an antique, but an 1800-style village in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And in the old chemist shop, there was a small little bottle in a display of Tilden's extract.
Mm-hmm.
Which was cannabis oil.
Oh, interesting.
But making it in the mid-1800s.
Yeah.
And also the cocaine that they used to feed the black slaves in the wharves in New Orleans.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know about that. George, and Coca-Cola had cocaine too. It's the first couple of years. Thank you, George. With you, welcome back. The dead cat is a rich ancestor. Ah, yeah. Okay. So, the dead cat story wasn't so much about the maggot, the fly egg that landed on the dead cat versus the fly egg that landed in the street. The maggot that grew out of the egg in the street was having a really hard time. The maggot that grew out of the fly egg that landed on the dead cat, came out fat and happy and he tried to say perseverance and hard work, but no, it's because he was born into wealth, basically. And very, very true. Sue makes the note. No, InfoTalk makes the note that increased heroin rates may have something to do with the banning of oxycodone. People have pain or they are addicted, one or the other, and so they turn to heroin. That's an interesting thought. Jim, listening to KTNF in Minneapolis, you have some info on In God We Trust on our money?
Yeah, hi, Tom. While waiting to get on, I remembered something else. Actually, that phrase reared its ugly head a couple of times during and after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had some 1937 silver dimes that had it on it.
Oh, okay.
But you were right about the congressional action. I think it was 1956. And one of the, if not the originators, at least one of the co-sponsors of the bill was shown to say, a communist cannot say the word God, therefore this is another way of smoking one out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I don't have the citation in front of me, but I remember the quote.
That's amazing. Okay.
Yeah, no, the logic doesn't change over the years, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate the call. It's good to hear from you. And Sue, by the way, notes that the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was when the minimum wage was set. And it was, according to the Wikipedia, was set at a high national level to render low-technology, low-wage factories in the South obsolete. Well, that's an interesting theory. Of course, you know, Wikipedia, when it comes to theories, you never quite know. It's crowdsourced, and sometimes it's the loudest voices that went out. But although they've been making some efforts to clean it up. Ron over at Everett, Washington. Hey, Ron, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Back to the caller, speakerphone, back to the caller that just called in. I don't know if any of his facts were correct.
Are you talking about our guest, Peter?
Your guest, sorry, not the caller. This goes back to a phone call you had last week with a guy who gave you a scenario about the convenience store owner having to raise his wages to $10 or $10.10, whatever it was,
right,
and asking him where he would come up with that margin. It's simple, and it's happening right now on a larger scale. We just don't think of it that way. By raising everybody's salary, the convenience store owner would sell more. That's where the money's made up.
That's right, and he sells more right because now it's been, because people because, are spending their salaries.
Because his neighbors and his customers have more money.
Right. As he sells more, then there's more demand for employment. As there's more demand for employment, it hits a certain point where it becomes what's called generative, where it generates more of itself. And so you raise the minimum wage. What that does is it stimulates the economy because it injects money at the bottom, because consumers are the real job creators. And
rising tides lift all boats.
Yeah, well, assuming that you have a boat, yeah. And this is the problem, is we've got all these people who don't have boats, and we need to get them boats, which is the minimum wage, right? And so we lift the minimum wage up, and what that does is it increases demand. Increased demand increases demand for employment. You know, people need more workers to meet that demand. Increased demand for employment tightens the labor market, reduces the number of people looking for jobs, which reduces the number of people desperate enough to take any crappy job at any lousy wage, which means that wages will be tightened up even more. You will reach a logical point where the market forces are in equilibrium.
Absolutely.
And that logical point is what we used to call the middle class. But we're not there right now.
If I could have said it that well, I would have a radio show. But right now it's happening, but on a larger scale. And it's happening with the Fed's dumping quantitative easing into the banks. Now, why is it that they don't argue that point? We're basically giving the banks
a minimum wage.
Minimum wage.
Yeah, yeah. And they're enough of a minimum wage that, Lloyd Blankfein can take a $20 million bonus, was it, he took last year or something like that?
Absolutely. I mean, look at the market. And, you know, not all of us are in the market, but look at what's happening to the market in the last, 2 years. And then one more point.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that they never argue – they always argue the point about minimum wage, but they never argue the point about the landowner raising rent on the convenience store. Where's he to make up that margin?
That's an interesting point. So should we freeze rents? In other words,
right?
Yeah, yeah. If you're opposed to raising the minimum wage, then obviously you're in favor of a law to freeze all rent, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you're also in favor of a law to freeze all wholesale prices. Because what happens if the price of milk goes up?
Well, and why can't I have the same price that Walmart has?
Exactly. Well, here's a good question.
Come on.
Why can't the government buy pharmaceuticals at the same price Walmart does?
Okay, Tom, now you're making them think.
Okay. The reason why is because Medicare Part D, which was pushed through the Republican Congress by Republican George Bush and pushed by Billy Towson, Congressman Billy Towson from Louisiana, who went on to be the head lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry, which is where he is now, I believe. He was on our show last year. Medicare Part D specifically makes it illegal for the government to negotiate drug prices with the drug companies or to buy at wholesale. If you get, so all these people on Medicare who are getting drugs through Medicare Part D, subsidized, you know, the government's paying for their drugs, they are buying at full retail. It's a $600 billion a decade subsidy to the pharmaceutical industry in the United States. It has nothing to do with the conversation we were having, Ron. I'm sorry I took it off in another direction. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Excellent point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I love callers like Ron, people who take what is right in front of us and say, hey, let's look at it a slightly different way and actually have a think. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The True People's Radio, or media, radio, TV, streaming, whatever, I don't know, probably tin cans, yeah. String? What's that string going out our window? Oh, that's the connection to the Senate recording studio. Hi, guys! How inequality hollows out the soul. Richard Wilkinson, two of my favorite people who I've never met. Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, and I mean that seriously. They wrote these brilliant books, The Spirit Level, Why Inequality Matters. They got this website, inequalitytrust.org.uk. The first sentence, one of the well-known costs of inequality is that people withdraw from community life and are less likely to feel that they can trust others. It's amazing. It's just amazing. More recent studies have affirmed the pattern we found. One looking at the 50 American states discovered that after taking account of age, income, and educational difference, depression was more common in states with greater income inequality. Data combined from 100 surveys in 26 countries found that schizophrenia was about three times as common in more unequal societies. It's actually, this is part of our evolved psychological makeup. This is in the op-ed pages of today's New York Times. It's called How Inequality Hollows Out the Soul on the opinion page. It's well worth reading. Another thing I wanted to talk with you about, and yes, I'll pick up, I see every single line is lit up. I will pick up your calls in just a second. But I printed this out, and then it somehow got buried in the Philip Seymour Hoffman stuff. And now I don't know where I put it, so I'll just riff on it. There was a piece, a really good piece, over the weekend in the Washington Post on Ukraine, what when I was a kid we called the Ukraine. And I don't know where it went, but in any case, this is something you need to pay attention to. Ukraine is a country that's about the size of Texas with a substantial population. I don't have the statistics in front of me, so I don't want to just go off the top of my head, but it's got more people. I'm sure it has more people than Texas. I mean, it's a country. It's a significant country in Europe. And in fact, there is a possibly apocryphal story that the word Ukraine literally means border. That Ukraine or point of passage, that Ukraine was the country or the area or the territory. It's gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth over the centuries. It was the area that was the dividing line or was straddling Eastern Europe and Western Europe. Or, you know, the Eastern Europe being all the way into Russia and then on to the, you know, the Asian continent and Western Europe being, well, you know what Western Europe is. And on the eastern half of Ukraine, pretty much everybody speaks Russian, because just to the east of Ukraine is Russia. And it is a breadbasket. The east half of Ukraine, let me draw sort of an analogy. Just imagine that everybody east of the Rocky Mountains spoke French, because it was contiguous with Montreal and Toronto, and Quebec is the French speaking province. Let's just imagine that the influence of Quebec was so great. We have a French speaking state province in North America, that the influence of Quebec was so great that in the breadbasket of America, from North Dakota down to Texas, the middle of the most fertile land, the breadbasket of America, everybody spoke French, and they thought of themselves culturally as being like Quebecois or whatever the word is, the French speaking members of people who live in that province in Canada. And that from the Rockies west, where there's lots of timberland and the land is not all that productive and there's not that many big cities, it's more rural. From the Rockies west, everybody spoke English and thought of themselves as Americans. Now, how long is that going to last? The western half of Ukraine speaks Ukrainian. The eastern half of Ukraine speaks Russian. The western half of Ukraine is more ethnically Ukrainian. Historically, the eastern half is more ethnically Russian. And there's this big battle going on right now. Literally, in the streets, BBC does good reporting on this. The U.S. media does crappy reporting on anything international these days, because ever since Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine and then Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, all the major, the three big networks in America closed most of their foreign bureaus. But in Kiev and other major cities around Ukraine, they're actually having riots. The president is the guy who, remember when there was a president who was, I think Yushchenko is his name, there was a president who was elected in Ukraine and there was all these allegations of vote fraud and the Orange Revolution happened, the people stood up and he got overthrown by the guy who was, kind of pro-Western. Well, that guy is back and he's the president now. And he's more aligned with Russia. In fact, he only learned to speak Ukrainian in his 50s. He didn't grow up speaking Ukrainian. He grew up speaking Russian. He's more aligned with Russia. And Russia, of course, has a strategic interest and a political interest in Ukraine, and they're a major supplier of fossil fuels to Ukraine. Ukraine supplies food to Russia. And then on the other hand, the Western Ukrainians, they want to align themselves with Europe. They want to be part of the EU. And over the weekend, there was this kind of Davos-like conference. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting where it was. Was it in Switzerland or was it someplace? Anyway, there was a conference, and Ukraine was at the center of one of the major discussions there. And John Kerry, our Secretary of State, and keep in mind, this is a country that's contiguous with Russia. So this would be like Vladimir Putin commenting on American-Canadian relationships. Kerry basically said, we're here for you, Ukraine. And we are opposed to, essentially, I'm paraphrasing here wildly. The BBC had a great quote. I'm not sure of the source of it, so I can't put it on the radio. John Kerry saying this, but basically saying, we, the United States, are here for you, Ukraine, and we oppose the meddling of other nations, that would be Russia in code, with Ukraine. So we're taking sides in this thing. And we're taking sides with the side that is out of power right now. And there's riots happening. This is a country that, people are not talking civil war out loud, but I will. This is a country that has the potential, in my opinion, for a civil war. And if that happens, Ukraine is part of NATO, or at least they have a mutual defense treaty with NATO. They also have treaties with Russia. There's the very real possibility that you could see a conflict happening where Russia's coming into conflict with NATO. If Russia comes into conflict with NATO, then we come into conflict with Russia. If we come into conflict with Russia, China comes into conflict with us. And you see where I'm going with this. I've been describing for about 2 years now on this radio program, and I describe in my book, The Crash of 2016, without a lot of depth, because I didn't want to turn it into a real fear-mongering book, that 2014 is not looking that a whole lot different from 1914. That we've got this kind of tinderbox world. And one major clash, in the case of 1914, it was the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo, but it really was the beginning of this kind of, you know, clash of cultures between the Serbs and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and thus the Russians and the Germans. And, you know, it ended up in World War One. Everybody had a treaty with somebody else, and so everybody got dragged into the fight. That we're there now, and we've talked in the past on this program about is the country where that happens going to be Syria? Is the country where that happens going to be Iran? Or is the country where that happens going to be Japan and China with the disputed islands? And I see now a third possibility. Not the Middle East, not Southeast Asia, but Eastern Europe. And if all three of those were to go down at the same time, it would be mind-boggling. So this is a time for us all to literally get down and kiss the ground and thank the gods that John McCain is not our president. And watch carefully.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Pay attention to Ukraine. Pay attention to what's going on in the Middle East. And pay attention to this growing conflict between Japan and China. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Barbara in Helena, Montana, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, Barbara?
I'm trying to hang in there.
Well, that's...
I'm disabled, so it's really not an easy life.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about the inequality in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wanted your permission, if you'd let me read a passage out of the Bible.
It depends on how long it is.
It's not too long.
Okay, go for it.
Woe unto him that builds his house by unrighteousness and his chamber by wrong, that uses his neighbor's service without wages and gives him not for his work, that say, I will build me a wide house and large chambers, and cuts himself windows and paneled it with cedar and paints it with vermilion. Shall thou reign because thou clothest thyself with cedar? Did not your father eat, drink, and do judgment and justice, and then it was well with him? He judged the cause of the poor and the needy, and then it was well with him. Was not this to know me, said the Lord? But thine eyes and thy heart are not but covetous, and for to shed innocent blood, for oppression and for violence, and to do it. Therefore, You know, he's going to...
Is that it sounds like Isaiah or Joel or...
Jeremiah,
of course.
Chapter 22, verses 13 through 18. But it goes on and talks about, woe unto the pastors that destroy and scatter my sheep.
Oh, I remember.
For the pastors, says the Lord. And then Jeremiah goes down further and he says, my heart within me is broken because of the false prophets. So
yeah. Do you remember the name of the guy who did the Crystal Cathedral out in California?
Schumer?
Robert Schuller, wasn't it? Schuller. Robert Schuller.
Schuller.
Yeah, Robert Schuller. In 1980, I went to the National Association of Religious Broadcasters convention here in Washington, D.C. I was running a community for abused kids, and I was hoping to raise some money from the wealthy Christians. I did not come back with a single penny. But Schuller, who I always thought of as just another televangelist, was the keynote speaker. And he got up and he preached Jeremiah 22. And at these preachers, I mean, this is a convention of TV preachers, right? He preached it at them. And he said, you guys are getting rich off your flock, and it is wrong. And there was virtually no applause. The room was stone cold silent. They hated him for it. I thought it was the best sermon I had ever heard. And the next year, the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker scandal, as I recall, broke. And it's just been one after another ever since then. I thought you might find that interesting, Barbara. Barbara, thank you for sharing Jeremiah with us. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, is on the line with us. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hi, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Is that a green wall behind you, or are you at the luxury suite there at Free Speech TV?
No, I'm not at luxury suite. No, it's a real wall.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. All right, so what's going on in the world today?
Treasury Secretary Jack Lew says, guys, you really got to raise the debt ceiling. I'm coming up against the limit, and I'm going to run out of cash, and I'm going to run out of extraordinary measures by the end of February. The deadline is this Friday, the 7th, where we run up against it, and he's going to start employing extraordinary measures after that time. One of the measures is not available to him, and there are two that they like to use, and one of them is. But the problem is that tax filing season's underway, and refunds are going to be going out the door faster than tax payments will be coming in, leaving the government shorter on cash.
Well, isn't that the first thing that extraordinary measure they could take is to withhold refunds?
I don't think they are thinking about doing that.
That's called funding your business with your financing with payables, and probably half the businesses in America do it. You know, you're supposed to pay net 30, but people pay net 90, and it's the equivalent to get a 60-day revolving line of credit.
They're not going to do it.
I wonder if they can't by law.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah, maybe they can't.
Yeah.
Maybe they can't. But they as soon as March the 14th, according to the Bipartisan Policy Center, the government could be within $5 billion of default, even under a very optimistic scenario.
Whoa. By the 14th?
The 14th of March.
Oh, of March, I see.
Yes. Okay. So basically the government will be unable to meet all of its obligations sometime between February the 28th and March the 25th. But at the same time, Treasury's got to make some big payments to Medicare providers and bondholders. Also, it's got some big checks, active duty soldiers, veterans, Social Security recipients, $26 billion to Social Security checks March the 3rd, and then $12 billion on March the 12th. So that's a lot of money when you've only got $5 billion.
Yeah, yeah.
So they've got some challenges, and they've got.
So have the Republicans commented on this? Because they control the House of Representatives, and the legislation to raise the debt ceiling has to originate in the House of Representatives. Have they said anything?
Well, they consulted extensively on this last week at their House Republican retreat, and Republican economist Douglas Holtz-Eakin spoke to them, and said to them, you have got to raise the debt limit.
Oh, and Holtz Egan was an official in the Reagan administration, wasn't he?
Right. Yeah. And he actually got through to them, some of the people who apparently have been resisting for a long time, and got through to them and said, you've got to raise, and did it with charts and various things and explained to them, this is why you've got to do it. Hmm. So it got through to them. But nevertheless, many of them are still saying, well, we want something in return. Of course, President Obama and the Democrats are saying, well, you're not getting anything in return. It's going to be a clean raise. We're not negotiating on this. This is not ransom.
Right.
So that's where it stands at the moment.
Right. So my prediction is that they'll do the same thing they did last time, which is it'll be a clean raise in real terms, but there will be some little fig leaf attached to it so the Republicans can go back home and say, we got something out of the president. And it'll be something like, you know, declaring Ronald Reagan to be the patron saint of St. Louis or something. I don't know.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
That could happen.
Yeah, there you go.
What else there, is there? There's a lot of backlash over Coca-Cola's multicultural America, the Beautiful ad last night on the Super Bowl.
This is the one where America the Beautiful was sang in a whole bunch of different languages, although every time they hit the word America, they all said the same word.
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
Massive backlash, racist tweets, and all kinds of things now. Hashtags and boycotts. Boycotts of...
Wait a minute. Coca-Cola runs an ad in which they have people who speak other languages and are of other colors or nationalities. You know, the we the world. And Coca-Cola is a multinational corporation that probably does more business outside the United States than inside the United States. They run this ad, and the right-wing crazies go off on a racist rant?
Yes, there's a boycott Coke hashtag on Twitter. People have gone off.
Are you sure, Victoria, that this is not the new Republican health care plan? No, you know, given that Coca-Cola consumption is tied to obesity, this might be their response to Obamacare. Boycott Coca-Cola, reduce national obesity rate, reduce our health care costs.
No, I think they're boycotting more than one at a time. They've gone absolutely ape bleep about this. The America the Beautiful should not be sung in any language other than America.
American.
Yeah.
Spoken like a true Brit.
That's how some of those some of the tweets are actually phrased.
Really?
Most of them are ungrammatical. Yes. Today we're throwing away all our Coca-Cola products and replacing them. They are trashing the CEO of Coca-Cola, who is originally Turkish. Glenn Beck has gone ballistic and saying that it's the whole purpose of the commercial was to divide us politically.
Wow. This is the same Glenn Beck who last week went on television and apologized for dividing America?
That's correct.
Yeah. Wow.
I thought you'd enjoy that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Cybersecurity expert Brian Krebs, who first broke the story of Target's massive data breach and retailer Neiman Marcus's less massive one.
I think we got nailed by that, by the way. This morning we got a credit fraud alert on my MasterCard, and I called the bank, and they were like, yep, you know, somebody tried to use it on a dating service or something. And I'm like, you know, I turned to Louise and said, is there something I don't know? She's like, and they said, no, apparently what they're doing is they're using, you know, these big online dating services to ding, you know, hundreds of them at a time to test if they're still good and, you know, the small charge. And so my credit card got replaced this morning, which is really disturbing because there's, you know, you got a bunch of things like your electric bill on there that hits it every month. So.
Well, now the hotel management firm White Lodging may have suffered a data card breach, according to Brian Krebs, exposing guests at Hilton, Marriott, Sheraton, and Westin hotels.
You know, when I was talking with the person on the phone from my bank, and I'm not identifying the bank for a whole variety of reasons, this among them, I said, is this the Target thing? And she said, it's not just Target. It's happening all over, and most of them are not making it public. And I was like, well, Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
6 minutes past the hour, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And, wow, interesting conversation with Peter Schiff about the minimum wage. We've been talking about how inequality hollows out the soul. We had a caller share Jeremiah with us. The middle class is steadily eroding. We've been talking about that. Is Ukraine the possibly a trigger? Is this is 1914 all over again theory that we've been talking about for 2 years now, where I've in the past talked about the Middle East and about the conflict between Japan and China. Could Ukraine have something to do with that? This falls not into the category of my hair's on fire, but more into the category of isn't this interesting? Although people were saying that in 1914. And then Archduke Ferdinand got whacked. And, of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman died from a drug overdose that if this was the United Kingdom or Switzerland, where heroin is a prescription drug and you can get it to treat the addiction of heroin as a prescription, Hoffman would no doubt still be alive. Anyhow, a lot going on. On top of that, on Friday, the Obama administration, the State Department, which is part of the Obama administration, it's in the executive branch of government, released a report, a much-awaited report, about the Keystone XL pipeline, the report that is supposed to set the stage for the president deciding whether or not to approve the completion of something that looks to me like it's already pretty much completed. So Ryan Kronowski is on the line with us. Am I saying that right, Ryan?
You are.
Thank you. So. Deputy editor of Climate Progress over at the thinkprogress.org blog. And Ryan, welcome. You've been on our program before, haven't you?
I think this is actually my first time.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. What the State Department doesn't say about the KXL pipeline, what is it that John Kerry and his associates at the State Department aren't telling us?
Well, the interesting thing about this report is essentially, I don't know how much you're familiar with the backstory of all of this, but you know, TransCanada is a company in, you know, surprisingly enough, Canada, that wants to build and complete this pipeline. You might have heard over the last few weeks reports of the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline being completed from essentially Nebraska to the refineries in Texas.
Yeah, we've reported on the show, and we had Daryl Hannah on back when they were trying to fight eminent domain and
right. Her
and a lady rancher. And yeah, we've been on. We're on the story.
Now there's, you know,
and the Koch brothers, you know, owning a bunch of the oil at the top and owning the refineries at the bottom. And I mean, you know, it's just, geez.
Well, what this report was about was the northern leg. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that is yet uncompleted because it needs this approval from the State Department because it crosses the border. So essentially what this report was, it's the final environmental impact statement, which means that it's this sort of next step. They were ordered to go back to the drawing board a couple of years ago to kind of redo this, but we're basically back in the same spot as we were with what the State Department believes this project to entail. What they're not telling us is essentially what they looked at was they're assuming that this tar sands oil, which is incredibly difficult to extract, takes a lot of greenhouse gases to actually get it out of the ground, and then it burns very dirtily. pardon me. So they're assuming that that is going to come out of the ground,
right?
No matter what.
Right, which is not necessarily an appropriate assumption. If there was even a modest carbon tax, because so much energy is required to extract the oil from this, it's not even oil, really. It's bitumen or bitumen,
right,
depending on whether you're British or American. And that has been ground up and put into a slurry with water, basically, to flush down the pipe, if I have this right.
I think you got it exactly right. So, yeah. You know, Reuters took a look at this middle of last year, and the presumption is this is going to happen anyways, and that's a sort of disingenuous thing to assume because, you know, this is 800,000 barrels of oil per day that are going to be coming down this pipeline if it gets approved.
Right.
That's very difficult to make up in rail shipments, and you know, rail shipments are pretty dangerous. You probably have heard, and probably I'm sure you've reported.
Yeah, we've had more explosions in the last year than we've had in the last 37 years.
37 years, you got it.
Yeah.
So you know, it not only is it not feasible, you know, economically, it's really difficult. They really are pushing. There's no reason they would be pushing for this so hard, if they'd just be able to just as easily get this tar sands out of the ground through another pathway.
Right.
So, you know, this, as you mentioned before, you know, we've had just as many oil spills in the last year as we had in the last 37 years. It's getting worse.
Here's the piece of pushback that doesn't make sense to me, and why hasn't the environmental movement pushed on this harder? They want to get this stuff down to the Gulf of Mexico. The only reason that anybody would want to get fuel to the Gulf of Mexico to refine is so that we can keep the poisons, the byproduct of the refining. We can have a larger cancer alley in Texas and Louisiana. And we can ship the diesel fuel and gasoline off to other countries. Now, you know, the jingoists are saying that diesel fuel and gasoline is going to go to America. TransCanada itself has come out and said, no, it's not. In fact, they issued a document over a year ago saying that you'd see the prices in middle America actually go up of gasoline if this thing was completed. So why isn't anybody asking the question, why can't they just refine this stuff in Canada? And then if we want to buy their gasoline or their diesel fuel, we can do that.
Right, and they're using it as an energy security. You know, the two main tenets of their argument are that it's going to create jobs, which there's been plenty. State Department itself, even as much problems as there were with the report, the report will tell you that it will create only 35 permanent jobs. So the jobs argument.
Long term, it's a small number of short term construction projects, and so you've got maybe one or two unions that think that it's a good thing for just a short while, But why not say, you know, yeah, we would be glad to do international trade with Canada. And then you've got these very disingenuous television ads that talk about North American energy independence rather than American. And everybody in America translates that into the United States, when actually what they're talking about is taking foreign oil, Canadian oil, and bringing it to the United States. And then we refine it here. We keep the poisons, and we don't even get all the oil and gasoline out of that. We just get the poisons. We get the cancers. We get the air pollution. We get the asthma. Has anybody ever asked that question? And do you know the answer to that question, Ryan? Why don't they refine this crap in their own country, keep their own damn poisons, and if they want to make a profit selling the gasoline and the diesel fuel, fine, we'll buy it from them.
I think that's a great question. I think that they would have to, their answer would be forced to be that they don't have the refining capacity. They're dependent on.
They don't want the refining capacity, because you can build a refinery a hell of a lot faster and easier than you can build a pipeline across a continent.
Right. I mean, the other side of that is there's just a study out today. I think the University of Toronto found that the environmental impact statements that were, like, the studies that were done up in Alberta. Mm. Of the environmental impacts up there. You know, there's actually been massive spills throughout as you extract the tar sands, because essentially what you do is you kind of push a lot of steam into the ground so that this goopy stuff can come back out. But they just had a study today that those statements, those impact statements, were not done as completely as, you know, as they should have.
So everybody's lying to us. And then we find that the Koch brothers might make even more profit on this than they're actually even worth right now.
Right.
So it's like, gee, I think there might be some money in the politics of this.
Absolutely.
Which I realize could be taken as a whack on the Obama administration, and this is not the Sean Hannity show, but, something is rotten in Denmark, or at least in Calgary, and we need to find out what it is. Ryan Kornowski, thanks so much for the great reporting you're doing over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org, the Climate Progress blog. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can read Ryan's piece and the 7 things that the State Department's not telling you over at thinkprogress.org. It's a great read. Check it out. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Boy, we've got a lot of really great comments on the board. And Rob in Bloomington, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Rob, thank you for calling. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Rob.
Hey.
You're on the air, sir. What's up?
I was just wondering what you thought about mandatory sentencing.
Mandatory minimum mandatory sentences?
Yeah.
I think they're unconstitutional. I think they fall into the category. I think what they do is they the Sixth Amendment guarantees you a fair trial. The Seventh Amendment or your right to trial. The Seventh Amendment, if I'm remembering correctly, the Seventh Amendment guarantees you the right to a trial by jury. The Eighth Amendment guarantees you a right to trial that does not impose excessive punishment, cruel and unusual punishment. And I think that that entire process that's spelled out in the Fifth through the Eighth Amendments, basically, that has to do with what happens when you go to court, when you are confronted by the legal system, I think that all gets blown up by minimum mandatory sentencing. And I think that, so my opinion is that sentencing should be at the discretion of the jury if you choose to have a jury trial, which is your constitutional right, or the judge if you waive your right to a jury trial, not to a legislature.
Right, right. I mean, have you ever known anybody to be under that legislation?
I have never had a personal friend who was sent to prison under a minimum mandatory. I have friends of friends who have been sent to prison on minimum mandatories on drug charges. Well, it was 20 years ago, but it was when they were first coming into vogue, and it was pretty awful. Yeah.
But even back then, yeah.
Yeah, and what it is now, you had Nelson Rockefeller pushing for this in New York State back in the 1960s and 1970s, when he was governor of New York. I forget what the year was, and then Nixon took this idea from Nelson Rockefeller, and Rockefeller, of course, was a Republican, but a moderate Republican. And Nixon, I guess, back in the day was sort of a moderate Republican. And Nixon took this idea and used it to declare war on drugs in, as I recall, 71. And part of that was minimum mandatory sentences. We'll scare the hell out of these people. They're going to know they're going to go to jail. They're not going to get any easy, queasy liberal judge, you know, that kind of thing. And at the same time, there was all this hysteria in the media about the liberal judges, and which didn't get any better in 73 when the Supreme Court passed Roe v. Wade. I don't recall when Miranda was, I think it was in the late 50s, early 60s, but the Miranda decision had caused everybody to be convinced that the Supreme Court was on the side of the criminals. And so, you know, the minimum mandatory sentencing was great law and order stuff. But now, you know, that was in the 70s. Now the people who are promoting minimum mandatory sentencing are lobbyists wearing $4,000 suits and $500 pairs of shoes walking around Washington, D.C. in the employ of the Correction Corporation of America and other private prison corporations. They're the ones who are promoting minimum mandatory sentencing. And the guys working for, like, you know, Rick Scott's drug testing clinics down in Florida and these giant chains of drug testing clinics, you know, so we can catch more people who can then be subject to minimum mandatory, because private prison is a major industry. Is that the answer you were looking for, Rob, or the information?
That's it.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call. I got to tell you, it's minimum mandatory is a horror show. It's a freak show. It's wrong. It's unconstitutional. Somebody needs to say it. 20 minutes past the hour. Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations and their media would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Jerry in Long Island, listening on WBAI in New York City. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'd like to discuss the Keystone Pipeline and the report by the State Department saying that the pipeline would have little environmental impact or problems, which I obviously need to respond to and refute. I obviously disagree with that. And to me, this is just one more of several examples, such as most notably the Obama administration's support of free trade deals. And there's so many other examples to me of how, in my opinion, the Obama administration is selling us out specifically to corporate special interests. I mean, after all, who other than corporate special interests will benefit from this pipeline, especially since, as you were mentioning with your guest, and it's true that this oil is going to be exploited. It's going to be exported outside of the United States. It's not even going to stay in the United States and help us with our energy needs. And with respect to jobs, I would question something that no one else is questioning, of how many of these jobs, we know that the jobs claim is exaggerated to begin with, but how many of these jobs are actually going to be American jobs? After all,
35 of them.
Canadian company.
Yeah,
yeah, probably
35. No, we know the answer. You know, they've said 35.
35. Only 35 are going to actually be American, and what, yeah, is the rest going to be Canadian? Yeah. Because it's a Canadian company.
This, I mean, there might be more jobs if we figure out that a 1,000-mile-long pipeline going right through the middle of America over the Ogallala Aquifer and others is a giant bullseye for a terrorist. There might be all kinds of jobs for the anti-terrorism various agencies of the federal government and the contractors who want to contract with them. But you and I will be paying that cost, just like you and I pay for the security, you know, for the Navy to guard ExxonMobil's tankers bringing Saudi oil to the United States. We pay for their costs.
Right. Right, and we're also going to pay if there's going to be any problems with the pipeline. I suppose if it's a pipeline, technically there won't be spills, but did it occur to anyone that there could be breaks in the pipeline? It's going to be going through cold regions of the country like Nebraska,
right,
and we have water main pipes breaking in New York City all over the Northeast when the weather gets too cold.
There's already a Keystone pipeline. That runs down into the center of America in St. Louis and then takes a turn and heads off to Ohio and feeds a couple of refineries. It's not as large in diameter as this, you know, Keystone XL. You know, it's like the XL is like extra large, right? I think that's what it stands for. So it's the extra large pipeline. But it's already leaked in several places, you know?
If
this was really about the United States having all the gasoline and diesel fuel that it needs, then why, you know, this takes me back to my original question. Why the hell don't they, you know, build a refinery in Calgary? And if they want to build a pipeline, you know, run diesel fuel through the pipeline. I'm not sure I'd be all that enthusiastic about a gasoline pipeline. It's way too volatile. But it's so transparent that what's going on here is they want to take this poisonous stuff in Canada, and the Canadians don't want to deal with it. They don't want to deal with the waste. They don't want to deal with the stuff that comes out of the smokestacks of the refineries. They don't want to deal with the piles and, I mean, the hundreds of millions of tons heavy waste, of physical matter waste that's going to pile up as a result. I think it's called coke, that is the result of the refining process. They don't want to deal with all that stuff. We've got piles of it right now in Chicago from the tar sands oil refineries. We've got piles of it in St. Louis. It's starting to blow around and really screw up mostly low-income neighborhoods, because just by coincidence they put them upwind of those kind of neighborhoods, mostly neighborhoods of, you know, minority neighborhoods. No, you know, it is just so obvious that the Canadians don't want to get their hands dirty, but they do want the money. They want to get the carbon out of the ground, and they want somebody else to take the poison. They want us to take the poison. They're going to ship that poison all the way down to the Gulf Coast, because down in the Gulf Coast you've got the states that are run by Republicans. They are the least regulated. They are the least likely to fight back. The people are the least well organized. The people are the poorest. The people are the most politically disenfranchised, large minority populations where you've got governors and legislatures who are working aggressively to prevent these people from even having the right to vote with these phony baloney ID laws. If you've got to have a driver's license. I don't care if you only make $6,000 a year and you can't afford a car. You got to have a driver's license if you're going to, you know, this kind of nonsense. They want that stuff to be refined down there on the Gulf Coast, where the poison from the refining stays in the United States. And why on the Gulf Coast? Well, it just happens to be next to a body of water where you can ship oil and gasoline and diesel fuel, even slightly refined crude oil that can be then used for other petroleum products and gasoline out of the United States and off to England and China through the Panama Canal and to Mexico and to any Brazil and, you know, all the developing countries of South America. I mean, you know, fill in the blanks that we can, you know. And who's going to profit from this? The Koch brothers and the refining companies and TransCanada and who gets screwed? America. And how these guys on the right can portray this as some sort of patriotic thing, how Sarah Palin can, this is energy independent, drill baby drill, we need the, you know, it's just common sense that there's something wrong here. And how the administration can support this, well, this is more proof that the Citizens United, the Buckley versus Vallejo in 1971, I think it was, and then First National Bank versus Bilotti in 73, and then Buckley v. Vallejo and then Citizens United in 2010, that these decisions that said that money is protected by the First Amendment and corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment, therefore, you may buy the politician of your choice, or you may threaten the politician of your choice with your enormous wealth, transnational corporation, that this has so corrupted our politics that even a Democratic president who runs on a progressive platform is going to sell us out because the money is so important to him and his party. I mean, it is tragic. We are watching an American tragedy play out. And then on top of that, look at, James Hansen says game over for the climate. If this second largest pool of carbon in the world is liberated, wow.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The Keystone XL pipeline is the essence of everything that is wrong with the Supreme Court hatching this doctrine out of nothing. 28 minutes before the hour, it's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And, the concern. Why Coca-Cola's Multicultural America the Beautiful ad was offensive? This over at Breitbart.com by Michael Patrick Leahy. Not the senator, no. He quotes Congressman Alan West. If we cannot be proud enough as a country to sing America the Beautiful in English in a commercial during the Super Bowl by a company as American as they come, doggone, we are on the road to perdition. Mr. Leahy says, as far as the executives of Coca-Cola are concerned, and then he goes on to a rant about, we're no longer ruled by the Constitution, we're not governed by the Anglo-American tradition of liberty. Instead, some kind of weird multicultural synthesis of the various forms of government in the world is what governs us. My paraphrasing of his language. You can read it over at Breitbart.com if you wish. Remarkable. Remarkable. How inequality hollows out the soul. The New York Times. Democratic Underground did a good job with a number of pieces peripheral to this, but this core piece by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. I've been talking about this couple for I don't know if they're a couple, but I mean these two people, these two writers. They're a writing team and a research team. I don't know if they're husband and wife or anything else, but whatever. For years, they have been turning out this brilliant work out of the UK on inequality and how it just saps the soul of a country. And now we find that the United States is the most unequal of all the nations. Now, we finally reached that point. 33 years of Reaganomics, and we are now the most unequal of all. We're number one. I mean, it's just of all the developed countries in the world. There's a great post here. I Ching Carpenter posted, I left you half this cartoon and the summary from the Oxfam report. I mean, Oxfam laid this out, right, over Democratic Underground. The 30 richest Americans own as much as half of the U.S. population. Excuse me. The 30 richest Americans own the same amount as half of all the rest of us. 30 people. The bottom half of America owns a smaller percentage of national wealth than almost all other countries and continents. Less mobility. You have a lower chance of moving into a higher economic bracket if you were born in the United States than if you were born in any other developed country. Now, when Reagan came into office, it was the opposite of every one of these things. This is all the consequence of 33 years of Reaganomics. And why the Democrats are not pointing that out at every turn Ronnie, you promised us if we cut the top tax rate from 74% down to 28% that the job creators would create jobs. Where are the jobs? Ronnie, you promised us that if we let the rich get obscenely rich, $2 billion a year, $100 million a day paychecks, if we let them do that at a very low tax rate, it was down to, you know, 15, 20% capital gains tax rate, that their money would trickle down on it. We would be raining. It would be a golden shower. Pun intended. I guess it was. Yeah. Ron in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Ron, what's up? Ron, you're on the air. Ron is not listening to his telephone. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Yes, I think you've raised some really important issues today. Now, with regard to the question of the Ukraine, I would take exception there in that I think that there are all way, way too many differences between 1914 and today, not the least of which is something we discuss, or you discuss every day, and I certainly discuss among my colleagues in academia, and that is that the role of multinational corporations has become exponentially greater in terms of global politics, geopolitics included. And given that fact, the likelihood that we are going to go to war, which unlike in 1914, where economies tended to be far more insular, so it's not as if the U.S. was concerned about not being able to sell Germany products because we were going to go to war, because most of what was produced in the U.S. in 1914, 15, 16, 17 was consumed here in the United States. Global economics wasn't something that was a fact of life as it is today. So given the fact that we have so many multinational corporations with an interest in global economic security, there is a countervailing force against going to war, unlike in World War One, where actually the interest was, well, heck, you know, we go to war, as a nation, we can go ahead and stop making cars, we can make tanks, we can make rations.
We can also loot the guys if we conquer them. And, you know, and make them pay back the cost of war with the Treaty of Versailles. It's an interesting point, Steve. Here's the flip side of that, though. I mean, let's go down this logical rabbit hole here. If multinational corporations don't benefit from war, then what you're saying is right. But I think that most of the really large multinational corporations, or not most, but many certainly, are in one way or another involved in the armaments industry, in the war industry, and
given what we see in terms of stock market profitability, I mean, when you have instability and conflict in the world today, it causes problems and it drives down values of commodities and other things because
that's right, which is a buying opportunity for rich people and big corporations. I mean, some real fortunes were made during the crash of 2008.
You're talking about short-term profitability versus long-term interest for corporations. So again,
I'm speaking on behalf of the long-term interest. I'm saying, you know, if they have
But you're saying
they're driven by the short term.
Let me just
finish my original thought, because maybe I'm agreeing with you. So where I was going with that is that, you know, A, many of these corporations have an interest in making war, and it's very profitable. And I mean, look at what the Pentagon budget has tripled since 9/11, for example. But then B, the question is, what kind of war? The kind of war that is really profitable for these corporations is long-term, protracted, dirty conflicts in parts of the world where things are not manufactured and there are no customers. In other words, let's have a war in poor countries. The second poorest country on earth in 2001 was Afghanistan.
But I believe that that's where your logic goes awry, because you were discussing something akin to 1914, which would, and by necessity, you know, involve a lot of very important players on in the international economic scheme of things, including the corporations that find themselves as home to these countries.
I'm agreeing with you.
This is not like Afghanistan. If in fact the Ukraine draws in a lot of other players. We're talking about big players, then the international economic realm is destabilized. So you can't ship a car made in Asia to the United States in a war zone.
Right.
You know, it's more difficult to extract oil and ship it somewhere in a war zone.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, all of these things. So when you talk about, yes, there are players that have an interest in war, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that today there's a much larger countervailing multinational corporation and multinational organizations out there that are profit from doing business that war gets in the way of, as opposed to 1914.
I understand that, Stephen. Stop for a second, because we're going to hit a break here in a minute and a half, and I really want to have this conversation with you. I agree with you. And that was one of the arguments that was made to sell the free trade deals. That was one of the arguments that was made for GATT, is that it'll diminish the probability of war because countries become more interlocked economically. Their interest, their self-interest in war is diminished. I think you're right. On the other hand, and I'm not saying we're going to have another world war. God forbid. I don't want there to be another world war. And I would love to be wrong that there are parallels between 1914 and today. That all said, if the economic order of the world starts to disintegrate rapidly, and that interconnectedness, that national and corporate benefit derived from interconnectedness becomes superseded by a benefit associated with nationalism, does your argument break down?
Oh, it absolutely does. But again, every
Do you think
day
that's
on
possible?
This show, not to mention everywhere else on the left, of which I am a part, we constantly talk about the growing hegemony of the multinational corporations and the small group of oligarchs. So we can't talk out of both sides of our mouth and talk about how important
what I'm saying is what happens if things change? What if there is an international economic crash that causes countries all over the world to start going protectionist and looking inward? Would that not, which
right,
you know.
Absolutely, but that's predicated on an assumption which you cannot find a credible economist that's going to go along with.
Well, actually Ravi Batra would suggest that, I believe, but you might want to ask Richard Wolff about that. But that basically is what happened
in the
30s.
They're suggesting a complete collapse. They're talking about instability, and what you're talking about would necessitate a virtually complete collapse of the existing global economic system. Not going to happen.
That's right. Well, I hope you're right, Steve. I really, seriously, genuinely hope you're right, because if we had a war like World War I, it would be devastating. And every war tends to use the weapons that were banned in the previous war. And now it's nukes. So I truly hope you're right. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. 15 minutes before you go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Inequality. How inequality hollows out the soul. Wilkinson Pickett, today's New York Times. This could play in as well.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Donna in Lincoln Park, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Donna, what's up?
Hey, I've been a listener for many, many years, and I'm finally calling about a point that I'd just like to make. I'm as liberal and as progressive and as socialist democratic as it comes. But there's this terminology that you use about Reaganomics,
mm-hmm.
and I just have a suggestion for what it's worth. I think people lose sight of, when they hear the general public, when they hear Reaganomics, they hear this great leader, Reagan, who was the hero of the 80s and created, you know, all this euphoria for the country. And they don't really put it together with what it really means in terms of economic policy. I'm just making the suggestion that you use supply-sided economics, which really drives home that there's a difference between demand-sided economics versus supply-sided, and that it's not just related to one American presidential figure. It's been an ideology that's been introduced and taken and ran with for decades, and it's been the policy for arguably 40 years. But I think that's just a point that when people hear Reaganomics, they get stuck on this conception of what, you know, the Reagan, the American hero, and they don't really understand what that really means, and that if you adopted more of a true explanation of what that really means mm-hmm. as an economic policy, then I think more people would say, yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
Supply-sided
That's a good critique. I need to, when I use the phrase, here's why I want to continue saying Reaganomics. Number one, the Reagan Revolution was a genuine revolution, just like the New Deal was a genuine revolution. Prior to the New Deal, we were living in a very different era. After the New Deal, America was quite different. It was quite different for 50 years. Then Reagan came along. And we've been quite different for the last 30 years than we were during the preceding 50. And so I think it's really important for us to particularly inform the young folks coming up, the millennials, that there was a time before Reagan when America was a different place. And we had a different economic policy. So when I say, would this meet your test here, Donna? If I was to say Reaganomics with things like, you know, low taxation on the rich, free trade policies that help transnational corporations, and a limitation of you know, regulation of big corporations and the destruction of organized labor. Because that really is the essence of Reaganomics. Would that work if I just kind of always threw them together?
Yeah, if you expounded on what that really is, because I think it gets lost to people that are less well-schooled in economic policy that don't
Well, that's my concern with saying supply-side economics, is I don't think most people know the difference between supply-side economics and demand-side economics, so that's just as confusing. At least they know who Reagan is.
Yeah, they're both elusive terms, unless they're really continually expounded on.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good thought. Donna, thank you. Thank you for the call. Thank you for the suggestion. It's an excellent suggestion. It's like, how do you message? How do you communicate in a way that people who are not already inside your head, who haven't been listening to your program for 5 years or 10 years, who don't know, you know, what you mean when you say, how do you do that? And every now and then, as a talk show host, it's easy to lose sight of that. So thank you, Don. I appreciate that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Earlier in the day, we had a couple of callers from people who were doing Keystone XL vigils today. And Laura in Chicago, listening to WCPT, is apparently at or going to one. Is that the case, Laura?
Yes, that's the case, and thank you so much for letting me go on. And, it's at 6 p.m. today in Chicago at 77 West Jackson in front of the Chicago State Department. We have a office of the State Department here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So please, everybody come on down. Let's say no to Keystone and no to tar sands oil and show them that we don't buy their lousy environmental report full of holes, full of lies. I was just on the Think Progress article that you were talking about, and it was excellent.
Yeah.
About the seven reasons. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's very well done. And so, Laura, that's an hour and 10 minutes from now for people who are listening to us live at WCPT and their affiliated various FM radio stations around the Chicago area. And in the address again was
77 West Jackson.
Yeah. Okay. And beyond that, wherever you might be in the United States, you might want to think about speaking up and speaking out. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Mark in Norwalk, Connecticut, listening on WBAI. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about World War One?
Yeah, I was listening to you in a caller a few minutes back talking about World War One, and I'm always struck by the fact of how little we regard that conflict. I mean, it's the 100th anniversary of that war,
right.
And it's interesting because World War One is the most important event in human history in the last 100 years. You know, you don't live the way you do today because of World War II. It's because of World War One.
Yeah.
You know, World War II is a continuation of the first conflict. Vietnam is a product of World War One / colonialism. Iraq is a product of World War One / colonialism. Libya, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine. We are living today with the residue of that war.
Right, and the destruction of the Ottoman Empire and the
correct.
Yeah.
The 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Treaty of Sevres, the Treaty of Lisbon, and Turkey was not supposed to exist.
Yep.
You know, and then you had the complete catastrophic collapse of all the regals. And then what followed, the Bolsheviks, the Nazis, the fascists.
And the Treaty of Versailles, I believe it was John Kenneth Galbraith said, it was either him or John Maynard Keynes, but I think it was Galbraith said, if this treaty is signed, then we are signing the death warrant of millions of Europeans because it will surely lead to a Second World War. And sure enough, it did. Treaty of Versailles bankrupted Germany and led to the hyperinflation, which led to the rise of the Nazis.
But you know, Tom, the interesting thing about this is that when Hitler, with Stalin's connivance, jumpstarts the European Civil War, he loses it in Moscow in 41. And the important thing about December 1941, this is the turning point of what we call World War II, because up to December 41, it was not a global conflict. It was basically a European conflict.
Right.
And Pearl Harbor brings the United States in. And the amazing thing about this is after beginning 1942, the two big winners of the Second World War take over this war. And this is the United States and the Soviet Union. And in 1945, Europeans, for the most part, will not be able to determine their own destiny till 1990. It's a fascinating progression of history here.
Yeah,
it really is.
By 1990, you're talking about when what's his name oversaw the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev.
Correct.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with your analysis. And what I was talking about earlier about Ukraine, and I did this in the first hour. I opened the show 2.5 hours ago about this, and went into this long kind of probably too rambling. I think I used up a whole block of time. About Ukraine is, first of all, we no longer, they don't refer to it as Ukraine, as the Ukraine, it's Ukraine. The apparently is because the word Ukraine means, or used to mean, in some ancient language, border or frontier. That Ukraine was the country or the region that was the separation between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, and now between Russia and Western Europe. And you've got Western Ukraine, where most of the population speaks Ukrainian and feels very Europeanized and wants to join with the EU. And you've got Eastern Ukraine, where most of the population speaks Russian. Most of them are ethnically Russian, and they want to associate themselves with Russia. And you've got this, and then John Kerry this weekend came out and basically said, we're with Ukraine, and we don't think Russia should be meddling in their politics. And you got Yushchenko, the president, who was the president who was overthrown in the Orange Revolution back in the day, and you know, he's back. And he's saying, oh, yeah, no, we'll go with Europe. No, we'll go with Russia. No, we'll go with Europe. No, we're going to go with Russia. And President Putin is offering him all kinds of incentives. And then we jump into the mix and say, OK, we're going to. And then on top of all of that, Ukraine has some sort of a defense treaty with NATO, even though they're not a full member. And yet they also are developing an alliance with Russia. So if Ukraine splits in half and there is the seeds of a civil war sown there, if Ukraine splits in half and they're having riots in the streets in Kiev, as you know, not as we speak necessarily, but you know, right in this era, it could, in my mind, it could be an Archduke Ferdinand moment. You seem to be much more conscious of the detail of the era of 1914 than I am. Do you think that that's a hysterical analysis?
Well, I actually teach World War One at Norfolk Community College.
Aha. Okay.
And yeah, there are parallels here. But what I find fascinating is Putin in the end is really not much different than Stalin or the Czars. They want that border moved as far west as possible, and I don't think Americans realize this. They don't.
Well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing that Polk did. You know, hey, let's take Texas from the Mexicans.
Correct. But the fascinating thing is here, and I don't think a lot of Americans realize this, that before the year of 1950, Russia had been invaded three times by the Germans in 1914, the Poles in the 1919-1921 war, and then again by Hitler on June 22nd, 1941, which, when Hitler did, launched the greatest land war in history. I mean, that is the land war that decided the course for the entire land.
And therefore, the Russians have a really good reason to say, we want to protect our Eastern Front. Right? Or our Western Front, rather. Anyhow, Mark, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Thanks so much for a thoughtful and informative call. I love it. And thanks a lot for listening to WBAI. We will be back tomorrow. And in the meantime, Jeremiah 22, all about wealth inequality. Just, you know, spoiler alert. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.